Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 152. I'm recording it on Saturday, July 25th, 2009. The P10 level today is 16. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of this selection is Corn Cob. The title of the podcast is Logic is an Off-On Switch. Emotion is a gradual awakening. There was a really good discussion of valuation-informed indexing at the Money and Such blog about a month ago. The guy who runs it is named Shaddox, his screen name, and is a lot of our discussions have been good over the past 7 years. Some have been interrupted by goon posters, but there have been some wonderful discussions. When the discussions are good, when you get intelligent people of goodwill, boy, they're really something. These discussions can be very exciting. And that I think the discussions we had at the Money and Such blog are some of the best. And you can find links to them at my blog, A Rich Life. And you can get to the A Rich Life blog by going to PassionSaving.com. And just look for the button on the left-hand side, A Rich Life. That's the blog. But there was a guy who participated in those discussions, and he goes by the screen name Frank Curmudgeon. And he's the owner of a different blog called Bad Money Advice. And Frank asked the question that I just thought was highly intelligent. Frank is not a believer in valuation-informed indexing, but he's not a disbeliever. He's a skeptic. He's open. His mind is open. And I was talking about, I think the theme of the post was that, you know, why long-term timing works, even though short-term timing doesn't work. That's the premise of all the investing material at PassionSaving.com, that the people who came up with passive investing were right. They came up with an important, powerful insight to discover that short-term timing doesn't work, but they made a horrible mistake in thinking that long-term timing doesn't work, and that mistake is the primary cause of the economic crisis we're living through today, and that we need to change that. And that mistake became revealed for the first time with the academic research Robert Shiller did, Yale professor, back in 1981. And the passive investing community has been reluctant to acknowledge Shiller's insights. They acknowledge them in an offhand sort of way, but they don't take them seriously. They don't explore the implications. And that's what I've been doing, and hundreds of my fellow community members have been doing in the Retire Early and Indexing Discussion Board communities for 7 years now. And I write up the results of our findings and our insights that we developed together at the PassionSaving.com site, in articles and calculators and podcasts and blog entries. So the claim is short-term timing, trying to figure out what the market's going to do in a year or two, does not work, is impossible. But that long-term timing, changing your stock allocation in response to big price changes with the understanding that you may not see a benefit for doing so for 5 years or possibly even 10 years, always works. Always gives you a better long-term return at greatly reduced risk. So I advocate long-term timing. I advocate valuation-informed indexing. I advocate rational investing. And I oppose passive indexing. I oppose the idea of sticking with a single stock allocation. So I wrote up the blog entry that kicked the discussion off, said, it was focused on the question of why does long-term timing work if short-term timing doesn't? And I gave reasons. And Frank, who, as I say, is open-minded and intelligent, asked this question. He said, well, how does the market know when the short-term turns into the long-term? And, it, you know, it's a beautiful question. The best questions, the ones I love, are these basic questions that just get right to the heart of things. How does the market know, Rob? You know, yeah, you're 5 years out. It can't. The data shows that what I'm saying is so, of course. And I don't think Frank denies that. But he just can't get his head around that. He's saying, yeah, you know, data shows it. Long-term timing always works. Short-term timing doesn't work. But maybe that's some kind of quirk, you know? Because how does this operate? How is there some bell somebody rings and says, oh, market, stock market, it's time to start. Timing should start working now, market. 10 years have passed. Market, please get with the program. So it's a good question. And I think about it a lot. And the purpose of this podcast, logic is an on-off switch. Emotion is a gradual awakening, is to explore why I think that is. And it's not, the answer is not complicated, and the answer is not hard to understand. The answer is odd. Coming in an era when we've had this passive investing stuff shoved down our throats for 30 years, the answer sounds like it's coming from left field. I think it makes all the sense in the world once you sort of get used to thinking about things in a rational investing way. You adopt the lingo and the thought patterns and all this. But it's odd. It's not something that would hit you. You see, passive investing is, there are two things in investing. There's logic. There's all this, the stuff they call the hard stuff. Logic, numbers, efficiency, you know, economic realities, all that stuff on one side. And that's the stuff the passive investing advocates are masters of. And I don't mean that at all sarcastically. I mean it quite sincerely. I have great respect and affection for the people who developed the passive investing model and the people who have promoted it to some extent, except that I think they got carried away and they've done a lot of harm. But, you know, I think there comes a point at which you have to acknowledge that you've made mistakes. But I do think they made a great contribution that hopefully we can build on and make better in the future. But all that stuff they're good at. But then there's this other side, this squishy emotional side, how investors feel about the future, how they feel about the stock market, how they feel about their personal job situation or their personal hopes for retirement, all this sort of thing. That's emotional. You generally can't reduce that to numbers. There's one exception. PE10 is a number that opens the door to understanding investor emotions, but most investors today don't pay much attention to PE10. During the passive investing era, that's been shoved, you know, out of sight. So the passive investing advocates not only do not focus on emotion, they actually have a negative reaction to it. Most of them, not all of them. I don't think Bogle totally has a negative reaction. Bogle is actually one of the best, I believe, on this particular question. He's a little more open to the emotional side, but a lot of them, they love tables, they love numbers, and they sort of love logic. It's a rigid kind of logic. It's not an open logic. It's a rigid kind of logic, but they like thinking that they're logical, and they have logical skills. It's just if they make a mistake, they have a very hard time acknowledging that. And so their logic sometimes goes off into crazy land. So the answer to the question, how does the market know? Stock investing, there's two things in it. There's this logic stuff, and there's this emotion stuff, and they behave according to totally different principles. So I believe, investing is not hard to understand. Yet, here we are in the year 2009, and I say our understanding is primitive. Very few people understand it. The problem is, investing is two opposite things pushed together. It's this logic, numbers, economic stuff shoved in with this squishy, emotional, you know, fear and greed stuff. And the people who are good at understanding the logic stuff have no skills in understanding the emotion. So they just ignore it. And the people who are good at understanding the emotion have no skills at the, you know, as a general rule, have no skills with the logic. And so they ignore that. And the two camps never talk to each other. And so the existing models are all sort of warped. They don't present a complete picture. And the goal of rational investing is to complete this picture, to integrate insights from different so-called camps, to take Bogle's insights and Shiller's insights and meld them and have a working model. And Buffett, I think, is in there. I think of it as being Shiller and Buffett and Bogle. And then you've got it all. Then you've got something that really works. So the answer is logic. Think of a calculator. Now, calculator is just a big logic machine. I think one of the reasons we have so many of these passive investing dogmatists on the internet is that computers essentially derived from calculators, and they have this mindset that everything can be reduced to numbers and everything can be calculated, and it's just not so. And there's greater representation of that personality type on the internet than there is in the general public. That's one problem. 2 plus 2. You program the computer, you plug in 2 plus sign, 2 equal sign, and the calculator does its thing. And it spits out the answer, and it's instantaneous. It's like a light switch going on. The answer is 4. And of course, no matter how big the numbers get, no matter how complicated the numbers get, the calculator can do the same thing. You could say, multiply 1,500,000, 624 by 7.231, and it'll tell you instantaneous. Logic is like an on-off switch. It just happens. It's like a calculation. It's yes or it's no. Emotion, it's not like that. Emotion. What happens when I always talk about relationships because they're the most emotional thing going on. But even say a baseball game. Let's get away from relationships. I do that too much. I was at a baseball game the other day with my boy. Say you're at a baseball game. And you want, a particular team. In this game, the team we were rooting for, this was a local game, and the team we were rooting for was down by 5 runs at the end of the first inning. So you're sort of depressed, this game's not going to go anywhere. And then they sort of, they came back, they got only 1 run in the bottom of the first, but they had bases loaded, they had a threat, and your emotions come up a little bit, and then you start thinking, well, it is possible to come back. And then the next inning, they had men on base again, and you're thinking, yeah. In other words, you don't really give up hope instantly. Your enthusiasm becomes tempered. That's what happens. But if the thing goes on for 5 innings, say they're down 5-0, and then at the end of 5 innings, it's still 5-0, then maybe your hope dies. It's a more gradual thing. Or, as I say, if you're in a relationship, it's good, and then something bad happens, and you don't give up on the person because something bad happens, but in terms of your outward behavior, maybe there's no change at all. But it's stored away somewhere in your mind. This person behaved improperly in this case, and it's sort of stored away, and the second time it's ignored, and the third time, and the fourth time. But maybe the eighth time, it really starts to affect you emotionally, and the level of your affection becomes diminished. That's more the way emotion works. Emotion, humans are made up of both. We don't, the way that these economists describe what's going on in the economy is they act as if we're just robots. walking robots. And, you know, they'll say, oh, if you give, you know, this is even true with these stimulus bills. This annoys me. You know, they adopt these stimulus bills. Stimulus bills, people will have these debates. Do stimulus bills work or do they not work? And this is actually, I think, a debate, if you really get down to it, between the two main schools of economics. You got the classical school, which is considered the conservative school, says that stimulus bills don't make sense because you're taking money from one sector and you're taking money from the private sector and putting it in the government sector, and that doesn't change anything. You're just taking water from one side of a pool and filling up a bucket and then taking it over to the other side and dumping it in there, and it doesn't change anything. And the liberal school, the Keynesian school, says no. People can reach a point, the people who spend, consumers can reach a point where they're depressed and they're frightened to spend, and by giving it to government, government will spend it, and government can sort of break the spell and thereby end a recession. And I think there's truth to both schools, and there's falsehoods in both schools. It depends on the circumstances. In the right circumstances, where spending really would help get the economy out of an unnecessary recession, getting government to stimulate things makes sense. So I don't go strictly with a classical approach. But on the other hand, the problem with the current stimulus, in my view, is we've had too many stimuluses. We just keep having them. And after a while, they don't work anymore. The whole idea of a stimulus is it has to be a surprise. And it shocks the economy back to life. But when you have one after another, it doesn't work anymore. And the reason it doesn't work is because emotionally, you see, there's a difference. When it's a shock, when it's a surprise, emotionally the reaction is, hey, you know, like Bush had these tax rebates. People say, hey, you know, maybe we should ignore the Bush, because it has to be a tax rebate that wasn't expected. That one was sort of expected. But if a rebate comes, at the first time a rebate is done, it sort of seems to be coming out of nowhere, and people say, hey, rebate, I never had a rebate before, that's cool, I'm going to go out and spend it. It's money from the sky. But if you have too many of them, then people just, that effect wears off. And of course, in the circumstances we're in today, the fear is so great that we actually didn't have a rebate this time, but it's the same concept, whether it's done through a rebate or it's done through some kind of spending program. People are scared enough, the rebate or the stimulus is not going to have an effect. So, but the troublesome thing, the thing that is hard to analyze, and because it's hard to analyze, a lot of economists just don't bother. But I think it's just too important to ignore. And PE10 is actually the best signal of it that I know of. There may be others that I don't know about. What you really want to know is, what is the deep emotional truth? In other words, how hard is it going to be to get people to spend again? And to know that, you have to know why they're not spending. The cover story we have today for the economy is, we're in a recession. Everybody says that. But the way they describe it is it's only going to last a short time. So it's a temporary thing. And the idea is the stimulus might speed up the recovery a little bit. But see, I don't think people think that. If you ask them, if you go to a party and you ask them, that is what they will say. This is the tricky part. You can't go by what people say. And this is, you know, an earlier podcast, I talked a little bit about Freud and how Freud, you know, was sort of embarrassing, some of the things he said, because he taught humans that we often don't tell the truth, and we're not even aware we're not telling the truth. We lie to ourselves. And see, that's what the emotional side of investing is all about. It's about the lies we tell to ourselves. So if you go to a party, or if you took a poll and you asked people, how long is the recession going to last? People would say, oh, you know, they would repeat what they're reading in the newspapers. And they'd say, oh, I don't know what they're saying nowadays. But basically they're saying, you know, oh, it's bad, but, you know, it's not that bad. Not according to the cover story. But what I think's going on is that on a deeper level of consciousness, and humans do not believe one thing. We all have different layers. We believe different things. Think about somebody who goes to the doctor and he says, you have cancer. He might believe on one level, he's in denial, and on one level he says, oh, it's nothing. You know, it's, and people do this all the time. It's nothing. Cancer, but it's nothing. But on a deeper level of consciousness, he's scared to death. Maybe even more scared than he needs to be. Maybe there is a chance of survival, and on some deeper level of consciousness, he thinks the chance is zero. That's why he's in denial, because he can't stand to face that. See, that's how humans are. We don't, the things we say, the things that are at the top of our mind is not necessarily what we believe on a deep level. So I think there's been a trauma, a deep trauma, not a small one. And the trauma is that passive investing failed. And people believe in it, or did believe in it. But see, now it's tricky. It's tricky on several levels. When I say people believed in it, people never really believed in it. People never believed in it, but they said they did. And now it's been revealed to them that they were right. It doesn't make sense. But they're not yet willing to acknowledge that openly. That's what I think is going on. So, now you might say, why do you think that? You know, where do you come up with this stuff? Well, I come up with it by participating on discussion boards. I've been saying for a long time, discussion boards reveal to us realities of stock investing that we cannot learn any other way. The beauty of discussion boards is you're not in a classroom. You're not working with a calculator. You're working with real humans who are investors, and you get to hear them. And I reported the safe withdrawal rate accurately 7 years ago, and it caused a nuclear explosion. And that tells me something is going on here. There's deep, deep, deep denial about this passive investing stuff. People are in great pain. And so that told me that all these people, and the people who did that, they did invest passively. That's been verified. So They said this, and they put their money at risk. They put their money where their mouth was. But they didn't believe it, because if they believed it, they wouldn't have been so defensive. They wouldn't have been so upset emotionally. So they were doing, and this is millions of people. I mean, I didn't speak to millions. I spoke to thousands, but obviously it's representative of the general public. There are millions of people doing this. They're investing according to their stated beliefs. But on a deeper level of consciousness, they don't believe it. And all you need to know that that's true, is to just think about what happened in the late 1990s when stocks were going up 20, 30% a year. Where the heck did the money come from? These are smart people. You think these people can't figure out the money had to come from somewhere? The money was being borrowed from future years. That's all. That's why we're now paying it back. Now, that's why the returns now are negative instead of positive. And they knew that. They're not stupid. People are not stupid. People are smart. But they didn't say that. They wanted it to be real. They wanted to add that money to their retirement account because they were fearful. They're afraid they're not going to have enough. And, of course, the experts were just, you know, encouraging that. And so they said, yeah, if the experts are willing to encourage it, I'm going with it. And they treated that money as real, but they knew on some layer of consciousness it was not real. And it was eating away at them year by year by year. And then, of course, what ultimately happened is their darkest fears came true, and they haven't yet totally taken that in. They've taken it in partway. And you see a big difference since the crash. There was a guest blog post up at the blog called Mulanomi. And I'm proud of the guy. Pinho is his name, the owner. And he did an earlier podcast, and I've had a lot of email correspondence with him to try to get these guest blogs up. And for a while, he was reluctant. And then he put one up, and the second one, he was slow. But he finally put it up, and I have to say, I feel a little bad this time, because the second one, I think it's a good blog post, but it was called Stock Volatility Kills. And I'll put it up. I'll put up a link at the Rich Life blog. But I've got no comments. I don't know. It's been up 2 days. Got no comments. And, you know, I feel bad because I feel like the job is to get comments. If you don't get any comments, you know, I feel like it sort of justified then for him not to run another one. I mean, I want him to run another one, but I can totally understand him not wanting to. He can't run blog entries if he doesn't get reaction. But my history is I've seen the sorts of things I said in that blog post, that guest blog post, I would have had people coming after my head, you know, 2 years ago with that, you know, with an axe. So in a sense, no comments is a positive. What's happening is we've gone from anybody who tells the truth about stocks, let's kill them. You know, we can't stand to hear that because we know on some deep level of consciousness it's true. And he's verbalizing it. He's saying it right out loud. He's violating the taboo. We've got to kill him. Got to silence him. And now we've gotten to a point where there's silence. And that's not good. I don't want silence. I want a national debate. But silence is a step in the right direction. We're gonna have to go through a silence stage before people can get to the point where they can, you know, say, yeah, I want to learn the realities. I want to talk openly about the realities. So I feel bad for Pinho, but there's a sense in which I think it's a good sign, but. It's not a reaction I've gotten very often, silence, but I have gotten it more often, I've gotten it more often recently. Recently, it's been happening more. There was a discussion board where I put up a post, you know, that was totally frank about the flaws of passive investing, and it pretty much got silence, and I thought, wow, I haven't seen that before, and now I've seen it a second time. So I think that's becoming sort of a trend. And people are just they're a little unsure of themselves. They're not as cocky. But the truth is, of course, they were never cocky. Cockiness is often an act. And what it was in the old days is it was a fake cockiness. It was an arrogance intending to cover up because the realities are already known. I mean, they're not known in detail. People don't know, you know, the details. But they know that valuations affect long-term returns. On some level of consciousness, I believe every single person knows that. And it haunts us. So, the answer to the question, how does the market know that it's a long-term is, let's go to 1990. 1996 is when stocks became insanely dangerous. They became a little dangerous in the early 90s. And 96, they became insanely dangerous. So, and then 2000, they started to go down. Slow leak, crash. So 96 through 99, 4 years, we just ignored the danger and kept bidding prices up. Well, and I don't say that people know the details. They don't know, you know, 96 was the year it became insanely dangerous. People don't know at that level of detail. But they have a sort of a sick feeling in their stomach. This can't be right. And that feeling grows. And it was growing all along. May have started growing before 96. I don't know. But certainly by 99, this was a widespread feeling that, hey, I want this to be true. I want this passive stuff to be true. I want this money in my account. But I have a feeling, you know, it's sort of like you discover a bag of money. You know, walking home from work in a bush, and you're sort of like, I'd like to, you know, it's $10,000. I'd like to keep it, but it sort of seems funny. I mean, did somebody steal it? And maybe if I reported it to the police, they'd let me keep it? You know, and you're sort of like, I want it to be true that somebody just decided they didn't want the $10,000. They dumped it in a bush, but I have a funny suspicion that maybe there's more to the story. So that's how that was, you know. People were getting this money dumped on them, and they wanted to keep it. But they had a strong suspicion that something here wasn't on the up and up. Something wasn't right. And they dampened down that feeling, and of course the experts encouraged them every step of the way. Ignore that voice. Just pretend the passive can work. You don't have to change your allocation. You don't have to do anything. But it continues to eat away. That feeling doesn't go away. And during the slowly crash from 2000 to 2008, prices were going down a little bit, but not enough to make up for what happened in the 90s. And on the one hand, it went down a little bit, should have made people feel a little better. But of course, once prices get to where they were in 99, there's no way to make people feel better. If they go up more, people get even more scared. They're already scared, and if they go up more, they're even more scared. But if they go down, they're even more scared, because then they're saying, wait a minute, there's no law of the universe that says stock prices always go up. So then they get more scared. So anything that happens, they get scared. This is why it's so dangerous to invest in stocks when they're at insanely dangerous prices, because anything that happens is going to cause a crash. If prices go up, it's going to cause panic and a crash. And if prices go down, it's going to cause panic and a crash. And if prices stay stable, it's going to eat away at people's insides and eventually cause a crash. Every option is bad when you get to the prices we were at in the late 90s. Every possibility is bad. That's why we can be so certain at those prices that we're going to have a crash. And a lot of people were certain. I wish that we would listen to them today. These are the people we should be listening to. Robert Shiller, Rob Arnott, John Russell, Cliff Asness. These are the people we should be listening to. These are the people who know what they're talking about. They knew there was going to be a crash. Now, they knew there was going to be a crash. What everybody says is, oh, if they're so smart and they knew there was going to be a crash, why didn't they tell us the day? Then we could have gotten out the day before. You can't do that, because the thing that causes the crash is a change in emotion, and this emotion stuff, how do you get inside somebody's head and find out, if, especially when people don't tell you the truth about how they feel? If you ask them, are you scared about prices going down? They say, oh, no, passive investor. John Bogle, no, stay the course. They would just give you these marketing slogans. And they believe them. That's the ultimate killer. They believe, on some level of consciousness, they believe them. I am personally convinced of that, that's generally true. So how are you going to ever, if they don't even know what they truly believe, how are you ever going to find out what they truly believe? It's impossible. But that doesn't mean it's not eating away at them. So what happens is it continues to eat away at them. So the answer to Frank's question is, the short term, in order to predict the short term, in order for short term timing to work, you'd have to predict the short term. To predict the short term, you'd have to know what people are thinking precisely. And it's hopeless. They don't even know themselves. So how are you going to know? It can't be done. But long term is very different, because as I say, when you are at the sort of prices we were at, everything that can happen increases the chances of a crash. If stocks go up, it scares people even more, because they know the crash is going to be even bigger. If stock prices go down, it scares them even more, because they say, oh, the crash has already begun, I better get out. And if prices stay the same, it eats away at their insides. They just keep fretting until the anxiety overwhelms them and they sell. So when prices get to that level, you know there's a crash coming. You have no idea when. So that's how the market knows that we're going from the short term to the long term. In other words, when prices get to an insane level, it could be the crash is coming the next day. You know, it doesn't have to take a long time. But the way that emotions work is gradually, as a rule. They work gradually. Now, as I was writing notes, I thought about an exception. I thought about Love at First Sight. People talk about that, the Beatles song, Little Help from My Friends. Do you believe in love at first sight? Yes, I'm certain that it happens all the time. Love at first sight is a real thing. Obviously, that's an emotional thing, to fall in love. And yet, it seems that it happens instantly. Well, I say that emotions happen. See, I do think it's true, though, that emotions happen gradually. Love at first sight, what's really going on is, see, emotions are funny. People think of emotions as being stupid. Many people talk of reason as good and emotion as bad, and I'm uneasy with that. I'm more of an emotional person, that's why. But Emotions are highly intelligent. Highly intelligent. Emotions can be very stupid, though. That's true. That's true. Emotions can be both. In other words, emotions can be super intelligent, more intelligent than logic, and emotions can be super dumb. Emotions can cause you to do incredibly dumb things. Emotions are sort of a concentrated intelligence, is the way I would think about it. So what happens when you fall in love at first sight is the logical person can't understand it. The logical person would go to a computer matchmaker to find their mate. They'd say, well, take a survey. Say, ask 150 questions. Do you like to smoke? What's your religion? What do you like to do on the weekend? On and on. You know, do you like to sleep with the window open or the window closed? You know, on and on and on. What's your favorite color? If you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be? You know, Beatles or Rolling Stones, which is it? Or monkeys? So that's how a logical person would do it. That's how a passive investor would do it. That's how a believer in efficient markets would do it. But love at first sight does work. Well, how does it work? It works because emotions are capable of just cutting to the chase. Our emotions are super intelligent. As I say, they're also super dumb. They're both. But they're capable of super intelligence. And what emotion can do is it can look at something about a person, the way they comb their hair, and draw a conclusion. And the conclusion is right in a frightening amount of time. The emotion is right a frightening amount of time. There was a movie, Doubt. It's about a nun and a priest. And it was based on a play. And I thought it was a pretty good movie. But I thought it was a good example of it. I liked it because the nun was, Meryl Streep was the nun. And the question was, early on, she suspected this priest of having done bad things. And she didn't really have solid evidence. And they had sort of a showdown, you know, at one point in the movie. And he says, well, you don't have any evidence. How can you say this about me? And she said, I know. And he was taking the rational point. It was like, you've got to show me I'm in a court of law here. You've got to show me the evidence. And she was saying, court of law, court of schmall. You know, I know. I know you. I knew. And he said, you had it in for me the first time you saw me. And she says, yeah, that's right. You know, what I liked about it is she was just so brash in acknowledging that this was true. He was treating it like this is bias. You're biased. And she was saying, I'm biased. You're bad. I know you're bad. I know your type. You know, she was not trying to justify it on logical, reasonable grounds. It's just, I know you're bad. I know. That's emotion was telling her that. Instinct. You could call it instinct. But she was very confident of her instinct, of the power of her instinct. Now, you can't put somebody in jail on that. You obviously have to have evidence. And he brought that up. He says, well, that's not going to be enough. You know, you're not going to be able to get me removed. And she says, I'm not going to have to. And he says, what? And she says, I'm not going to have to. He says, you're going to confess. But again, she was going with her instinct. She says, I'm going to make you confess. Because this bothers you. What you did bothers you. I can see that. And you're going to confess. You're not going to want me around pointing it out. See, she felt very comfortable going by instinct. She felt very comfortable going by emotion. She was perfectly smart. She was perfectly intelligent. But she was comfortable with her emotion. Emotion is super intelligent. So when you have love at first sight, your emotion saying, fall in love with this person. This is the one. And your mind is saying, what? You don't even know this person. You've never even gone on a date yet. What are you talking about? And the emotion is like, date mate. Don't worry about it. This is the one. This is the one. And you've got to listen to that. You've got to listen to that. I never would tell somebody not to listen. Now, as I say, emotion can be super dumb, so you have to be careful. You do have to be careful. Emotions can tell you exactly the wrong thing to do. In other words, emotions, I don't know how to say it exactly, how to articulate it. They're keener than intelligence. So what's really going on with You Fall in Love on First Sight is it's not that your emotion is coming to a decision quickly, really. What's really going on is your emotion has been pondering this question of who the right person is silently in the background for many years. And you meet this person and the pieces click and your emotion tells you, this is it. And I don't need to discuss it. I don't need to debate it. This is it. And so it may have taken 5 years for your emotions to decide this. It's not really at first sight, but it's the first time you saw the person. In other words, the person enters the room, but what the emotion is hungering for has a long history. And so the same thing happens with the stock market. What happens is, you know, in September of 2008, whatever stocks fell 40-50%. I think the total was 57, but not all in 1 month. We've been waiting for 10 years for that crash. We've been pondering it in our hearts. We've been thinking about it. We've been getting scared, getting nervous each time there was a little drop. And September 2008 came and we said, yep, this is it. This is the one. And we all did it. I mean, not every single person. There obviously were some people buying or there's some people holding. But it hit a lot of people all at once. And that's the way emotion is. So, and I think that's going on today. The reason I say that is every time we've been to insane prices, we have ultimately fallen to a P10 level 50% lower than where we are today. So I think the odds are that's going to happen again. We have another 50% price crash. I don't know for sure. You know, if you had asked me before the crash, are you totally sure there's going to be a big stock crash? I would have said, yeah, 90% sure. 90%. You can never be 100%, but I would have said 90%. But if you ask me, how sure are you that we're going to fall, you know, below a P10 level of 10, we're now at 16, I would say 70%. So it's not as strong. Because there's no economic reason why it has to happen, whereas economically it had to happen before. But I believe, and all the evidence that I look at points that way, that we suffered this trauma in learning that passive investing is not going to work, but we didn't let it all in. We took as much as we could take. We can only stand so much bad news at one time, and we let as much in as we could. That brought us down. Ultimately, the lowest we ever went was PE10 of 12, and now we're back at 16. We let it in about halfway, and it's going to take some more time, and I don't know how much more, whether it's another year, another 2 years, another 3 years. But so the point here is our way of analyzing stocks, when you look at all the articles in the papers and on the websites, people, they're always using logic. All the articles are made up of logic, you know, logic points, numbers and data points and all this sort of thing. And there's obviously a place for that. I'm not saying that's bad, but what we need to get a fuller picture is more discussion of emotions, which you cannot reduce to logic. I mean, you can talk about it logically. I'm trying to do that in the podcast. But some of these things almost don't sound totally logical. That's why I use comparisons a lot. Is love at first sight logical or is it not? It's not logical. You can't reduce it to a syllogism. However, the truth of the matter is, I don't think life could exist if it was pure logic. We would be robots. We'd be programmed robots. All kinds of decisions are emotional that we make every day. When you choose, you know, am I going to eat another piece of cake or not? You eat one piece of cake after lunch. Are you going to eat a second piece? That's an emotional decision. It's not really a logical decision. Somebody could remind you of the fact that you're trying to lose weight. And you could say, well, okay, the logical thing would be not to eat it. The emotional thing might be, okay, I'll show you. You're not going to boss me around. I'm going to eat it just for that. I'm going to eat three pieces just for that. In other words, this is why I say emotions can be dumb. Emotions aren't necessarily smart. But emotions are powerful and they're concentrated. It's like emotions are very quick and they're concentrated and they develop over years. That's what's really hard about emotions is that, you see, when you write an article in the newspaper, you're drafting a logic statement, and you like to think it would persuade people. But the trouble is, the emotion is a filter. Everybody has their own emotion, and they filter what they read. And the emotional filter is much stronger than any logic of the words. A great example of this is the Sarah Palin phenomenon. Regardless of whether you like her or hate her, there's no question, I don't think anyone would disagree, there are people who love her to death, and there are people that cannot stand her. And just about everyone will acknowledge, it's a little hard to understand why why feelings are so strong, because she hasn't really said that much. You know, she said a few things. You know, obviously she said a few things against Democrats, but she was running as vice president. That's sort of the job, to be the attack dog. And so that wasn't out of the norm. The things she said were pretty much in the norm. But some people look at, some people cannot stand what she stands for, and other people love what she stands for, and it's intense on both sides. Well, it's because she symbolizes something, obviously, to people on both sides. And the emotion there, the filter, in other words, she says the same words to both people. But the one here, one thing, and the other here, a different thing. And of course, this is true with all political candidates, but it's intensely true with Sarah Palin, but it's true with all of them. But the point here is, there's a conflict between the logic. You know, if you write an analysis, the analysis is logic. But the people reading the analysis filter it through emotion. Well, the same thing's true with stocks. We've all got this set of experiences that filters what we say. So, for example, there were people in 1996 who looked at the same data I looked at, and they said, stocks are insanely dangerous. You know, I say they became insanely dangerous in 96. They were a little dangerous before that, but insanely dangerous in 96. There are lots of smart people who saw that, and they said, hey, I'm going to make a killing. Stocks are insanely dangerous. All these experts don't seem to get it. They're talking about buy and hold, passive investing. I'm going to short the market. I'm going to get rich. Market's going to collapse. I'm going to get rich. And they got wiped out. Because just because stocks were insanely dangerous in 96 doesn't mean they can't go up 30% and then another 20% the next year and then another 20% and then another 30%. There's not a thing that says that can't happen. It depends on the backstory. It depends on what emotions are going on in the minds of investors. And in 96, the emotion was ignore this price problem. As I said, emotions can be dumb. Emotions can be intensely smart. Emotions can be intensely dumb. And emotions are not formed in a second. The reaction's always quick, of course. The emotional reaction is instantaneous. But the thing that prompts the reaction has a long history, usually. So when stocks went up in 96, there were long historical reasons. I think the biggest reason was the promotion of passive investing, personally. But there were more than one factor. The middle class fear about falling behind, you know, financing their retirements, all that. There were all sorts of things. But, you know, that caused it to go up. A lot of people would like to analyze that and say, well, the next time that happens, I want to know in advance. But I think it's almost impossible. Maybe somebody really smart could do it, but it's awful hard. Because people don't know their own emotions. But what I'm saying is, the more we kid ourselves, we were kidding ourselves in 96 through 99, the more we do that, the more fear there is in the backstory from that point forward. So we were working off of a positive backstory in 96 and turning it into a very dark backstory by 99, so that from 2000 forward, the backstory was dark indeed. And the question today is, of course, is the backstory now better or not? The economic story is better because economically we're back at fair value, but I'm afraid that the emotional backstory has not healed in my opinion, assessment. People are still in trauma. And the big reason I say that is if you go on discussion boards, as I say, you still get negativity if you report the numbers accurately. You still have boards where honest discussion of safe withdrawal rates is banned. and you still have blog posts you put up where you know they say important things and you don't get a reaction. And all of this shows that emotion is still dominant. People have not yet come to terms with the realities of stock investing, the realities of the flaws in passive investing. And until that happens, I don't think we're going to be able to go up. We're always going to have this fear until we deal with that problem. All right, now let's try to make this practical. I'm saying it would be almost impossible to analyze these emotional inputs. I'm describing the emotional inputs. I'm saying they're important, I'm saying they have a big effect on prices, and therefore they have a big effect on your long-term result. But I'm saying you can't analyze them. So in a sense, I'm saying it's impossible to invest. But you don't have to. I think the answer is you don't have to analyze them. What I've done, what I'm trying to do in this podcast, where I'm saying how logic is different than emotion, understanding it is different. I'm not saying that you need to analyze the emotion. It could be an interesting game to try to understand it. And I'm offering some theories here as to, people always ask what's going to happen in the future, and I don't know. Nobody knows. But when I give my analysis where I think there's going to be another crash, that's based on an emotional analysis, an emotion-rooted analysis. But you can't do that, and I mean, as I say, I can't do it reliably. I'm just giving an opinion. So, how do you invest? Well, the beauty of PE10. PE10 is the price of the index over the average of the last 10 years of earnings. The beauty of the PE10 tool is it's a number. It takes this emotional stuff and translates it into logic stuff, really. It provides a tool that a truly rational investor is one who acknowledges the importance of emotion. So it takes the emotional content of stock investing and translates it into a tool that can be used in a rational analysis. So if you had to decide to change your stock allocation based on this, I'm saying you can't only look at the logic. That won't work. You're leaving out 50% of the investing experience, at least. So that won't work. So what to do? The thing you might try to do is to include an analysis of all the emotion in there. But that's too big a job. Very hard job. So that's a no-go. So what do you do? What you do is you look at one simple thing, PE10. And you integrate that with your logical analysis, which is essentially the analysis that the passive investors do. The passive investors are smart, and they're doing a good analysis. So start with what they have, but add an element. Add the element that's missing in the passive investing model. The element that's missing is emotion. But don't bother trying to figure out the emotions. Don't say, "Oh, I'm gonna get some investors and put them on a psychiatric couch and try to figure out what they're gonna do." That obviously is not gonna work. All you have to do to know the emotion present in the market is look at the P10 level. It tells you. If the P10 level is 14, the market is fairly valued. That means the long-term value proposition is good. And you can safely invest in stocks. Now, is that true today? It is. I'm telling you, I think there's going to be another crash. I put the odds at 70%. But if you want to take a bet, and you say I don't want to invest in stocks until that crash has passed, well, do that. But I'm telling you, there's risk in that. There's risk in that. And the risk is, can't figure out the emotion, and you might get it wrong. It's true that in the last three times we went to insane prices, we went to a level, P10 level, 50% lower than where we are today, but that doesn't prove that's going to happen the fourth time. And there might be some dynamic, some emotional dynamic going on this time that's going to change it. We just don't know. So, if you want to take my 70% thing to the bank, you know, it's up to you, but I don't think it's a terribly good idea. I'm not God. Somebody else will say it's 60% or 80% or 10%. I don't know. But I think the way you have to think about it is this. If you're investing for the long term, if you know that you can take a big hit, a big crash, and not sell, you can buy stocks today with reasonable confidence that in 10 years, your return will be not bad. At least not, maybe better than that, but at least not bad, maybe good. If you can't take a 50% crash, then lower your allocation until you get to the point where you can. Because I do think you have to acknowledge a 50% crash is a realistic possibility, given that every time in the past when we've gone to the price levels we were at before the crash, we went 50% below. Ultimately, we went 50% below where we are today. So you have to be willing to take a 50% crash in order to invest in stocks today. If you can, then you don't have to wait. You don't have to wait till after the crash. The probabilities are on your side today. But if you can't take another 50% crash, and I think many people are in that circumstance, given that almost everyone was overinvested in stocks before the crash because of this massive promotion of the passive model. If you can't take a 50% hit, then you've got to lower your allocation until you get to the point where you can. So that's where it stands. What I'm trying to convey is, you can't go passive because you're ignoring 50% of the investing project if you only look at logic and you don't look at emotion. If you ignore valuations, you're ignoring emotion because overvaluation and undervaluation are emotional phenomena. And if you think the market's efficient, you are ignoring all emotional phenomena. You are assuming rationality. You're assuming something that doesn't exist, and it's irrational to assume something that doesn't exist. So you're asking for trouble. But if you try to analyze all the emotion, I think it's fine to think about it, but you just can't take it too seriously. Or you'll turn out like those people in 96 who shorted the market and got killed. You start thinking you understand the emotion. You can't ignore emotion, and you can't factor it in totally. You can't ignore it because it's too important. It's the elephant in the living room that nobody likes to talk about. And you can't factor it in totally because it's just too amorphous. But what you have to do is factor it in to the extent you can. And the way you do that, I believe, is by looking at the PE10 level. When you're at 14, you're at fair value. And the long-term value proposition is good. And we've got, you know, historical data showing this going back many, many years. And when you're low, if we go to a 50% drop, then the long-term value proposition is even better, much better. But when we're double fair value or triple fair value, as we were before the crash, the long-term value proposition is horrible, and you don't want to be heavily invested in stocks. So that's the message. The message is don't ignore valuation, because then you're ignoring emotion, and that's 50% of the investing project. But don't try to figure it all out either, because it's real hard to grab hold of. Emotion is harder to interpret than logic, and you're not interpreting your own emotion. You're interpreting the emotion of millions of people. It's tricky. But if you want to keep it simple, this PE10 number takes all the emotion in the market and encapsulates it in a number, and it tells you. It doesn't give you your precise return. It gives you a range of possibilities, and it tells you the odds of various returns within the range of possibilities. It assigns odds to them. And that tells you what you need to know to make informed decisions, not perfect decisions, but informed decisions. Far better informed than the passive investors could ever make. And that, I think, is enough. Given how appealing stocks are as an asset class, you add in that element, which has been ignored for the 30 years that passive investing has been promoted, add in that missing element, and I think you've got something that works. Not perfectly, but works a whole lot better than we have today. And I guess the last point, just to sum it all up, is that we have to stop. What's going on today is frustrating because, you know, we have this academic research dating back 28 years of great power, and we all could be investing far more effectively. But what we've got today is a lot of people who are emotionally damaged because they believed in passive investing, they made a mistake, and now they can't bear to accept it, to acknowledge it. And so all of this energy is going to ignore the realities, to avoid the realities instead of to learn the realities, which is just crazy. So we don't have to say, we don't have to make it an either or. We don't have to say, hey, we're going to figure out all the realities or nothing. We should go for this middle ground where we say, look, some of these emotional realities really are beyond us, but they're not all beyond us. We certainly can take valuations into account, and that gives us a pretty good idea. But when we're trying to examine, does this make sense? Does this new rational model make sense? We can't analyze it the same way we analyzed the passive model. We can't look for pure logic because the thing we are examining is not made of pure logic. It's emotion. So that's the answer to Frank's question. How does the market know when we've switched from the short-term timing doesn't work, never works. Long-term timing always works. How does the market know when we have shifted from the short-term to the long-term? The market knows because the market is us. And we know. On some level of consciousness, we know. And the truth of the matter is, I keep saying that I want everyone to learn that valuations affect long-term returns. We all know that today. Otherwise, we wouldn't be so upset about hearing it. We all know that. The struggle today is to acknowledge what we know. We have this knowledge within us. Have you ever known somebody who was emotionally crippled? And they know what they need to do, and they can't do it. I mean, the perfect example I bring up from time to time is an alcoholic. He knows he needs to stop drinking. Nobody needs to tell him. He knows. But he can't bear it because of all the pain he's already caused to himself and to his loved ones. He can't bear it. And what he needs to do is to learn an emotional truth. And sometimes he'll just see the damage he's done to his wife or his daughter or his son. And it will hit him. And that day, he'll go to the first AA meeting. See, that's the great power of emotion. Emotion can block him from doing the right thing for years. And it's horrible to watch. But emotion can, in a split second, cause him to do the right thing. And we can't predict it. Nobody can predict when an alcoholic's going to hit bottom, as they say. And no one can predict when a market's going to hit bottom. But I think what we need going forward is to become more self-reflective. The whole key to the rational model, the change from the passive models, the passive model says block out all knowledge of emotion. That's the weakness in this model. We all know it, and it scares us to death. So make it taboo. Don't talk about it. And the rational model says just the opposite. It says talk about it. Always look at valuations. Never avoid valuations. That doesn't mean you have to always be changing your allocation. You might only make one allocation change every 10 years, and that's fine. But always be talking about it. Don't wait until the 10 years have passed to start thinking about it, because then it's too late. Then this emotion is a gradual awakening. If you wait 10 years, all your emotions are going to be in the wrong place, and you're not going to be able to act. So get involved on the emotional side from the first day, but only make decisions rarely, only make changes rarely because emotion is so murky and you can't rely on on the inputs except in cases where the emotional case is so strong that you know you have to take action. You know, when you get to a P10 level of 25, there's no question about it. When you get to a P10 level of 20, you've got to start thinking about it. You're in the danger zone. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.